and others, other people living in the United States, that following the murder of the Jesuits, which I'll talk about in a session tomorrow morning and talked about last week, and then following the invasion of Panama. And I talked a little bit about what was behind the invasion of Panama. If someone wants to ask me a question about that later on, I will do that. But this will give you a sense, a couple of things I want to read, of how at least some segments of Christians living in Central America view the United States as an empire. And they're lifting the question up to us, why aren't you being more faithful? That's the question they're posing to us. Why don't you understand that there's a clash between your Christian faith and being citizens of the United States, that they're not harmonious, that Christianity and patriotism aren't the same thing? So just a couple of quotations which will give you a flavor of that. The first, as I said, is from the Latin American Council of Churches. It says, "Now with Panama invaded, we Latin American Christians feel indignant when we hear the count on North American victims of the operation that was planned with evil intentions and hypocrisy, and yet nothing is said about the hundreds or thousands of Afro-Indo-Latin American lives destroyed physically or psychologically by such an abominable adventure, which is a repetition of past crimes in Santo Domingo, Grenada, Guatemala, Nicaragua, El Salvador, in an endless list. We ask ourselves then, how long will Christian churches in the United States continue to tolerate, and in some cases even justify, these actions that not only violate the most basic human rights, but also the right that the weakest or smallest countries have to make their own decisions and to write their own history?" So that's one quote. And the second one, which is, again, I'm supposed to promote this because the bookstore is thrilled that they've sold 30 of 40 copies. So if you want a copy of this book, there's 10 left, called War Against the Poor, which is kind of the basis of the five sessions I've been doing. But this is a quotation from a poem by a very famous bishop in Latin America, from Brazil. And it's entitled Ode to Reagan. And this is just a little tiny clip of it. "Empires no longer suit the race of human beings. You may think you're the owners. You may have everything, even God, your God, the blood-stained idol of your dollars. But you don't have the God of Jesus Christ, the humanity of God. I swear by the blood of God's Son, killed by another empire, and I swear by the blood of Latin America, now ready to give birth to new tomorrows, that you will be the last emperor." So that's just to give you a flavor of what Christians, not all Christians, obviously the churches are divided in our country, the churches are divided in many places, but a significant section, and if you follow the logic of what I did the last week, we've been trying to look at the majority of people who are poor in Central Latin America and what their struggles are. And people coming out of a faith perspective that's trying to in some way address the structural roots of that poverty, this is the kind of message that they're bringing to us. Okay. That's as background. And now what I'd like to do, which I've been doing throughout the week, is encourage you to get into groups of two or three. And I'm going to do it a little bit different this time. I'm going to give you first one question and ask you to talk about it for about 5 minutes. And then we'll maybe quickly brainstorm what you've come up with. And then I'm going to give you another question right away and have you do the same thing and come back. And then we'll see how to proceed from there. But the first question that I want to ask you to reflect on is, do United States flags belong in our churches? And what's the theological and the political significance of that? So why not? I want you to come up with that And yeah, let's start there, and then I'm going to hold another. Remind me if I forget. I want to share a quote about flags. So about 5 minutes in small groups on that question. And as these sessions are being taped, I would encourage anyone listening to it on the tape to pause and reflect upon the questions, just as we are doing in small groups, even though I know they pause the tape. And I will try to summarize or repeat your brief responses. What did you come up with? Should they, why and why not, should flags be in our churches? I assume we had different.
The first thing I thought when you said that was, I was the whole business separation of church and state. Not that that still is in somebody's situation now, but originally it really was the separation of church and state. So that I thought, oh, I guess you really maybe shouldn't have it there.
And it's interesting because that is one of the things that the separation of church and state is one of the things that comes up in a lot of contexts. And usually it's a context in which the state is trying to guarantee the rights of others so that you don't have religious persecution of minorities. That seems to make sense to me. But then we turn around as churches and we don't separate. We put the flag next to the altar. That seems to me to be a relatively large contradiction. So I think that's an interesting way to think about it. Separation of church and state. And yet here's a case where the churches are voluntarily blurring the images, at least. What else did people say? Yeah?
Well, we got off on a tangent because it just brought to mind the story, a true story of a pastor who served in a rural church in Iowa during World War I and wanted to fly the American flag in church, and he literally run out of town.
In World War I, he wanted to have the flag in the church, and
yes,
he was run out of town in Iowa.
Well, where did this start? When did it start? Has it always been?
Uh-huh.
Because I'm just in a blank, not knowing a thing about when the flag was...
You know, I don't know that either, but it wouldn't surprise me if that... I mean, that'd be a fascinating thing to look at, and I wonder if it wasn't after World War II, because after
that's
World War II...
That's what they were saying.
Or during World War II.
Coming in
okay.
To our church during World War II. And also the Christian flag, neither of which we had in my home church in Albertville, Minnesota. I know it was during World War II. I think it was part of the patriotism.
I mentioned in one of the earlier sessions that we did, we had a reflection upon the impact that the Vietnam War had on our families, our communities, our churches, etc. And one of the things that I mentioned was that it created great division in my family for a long time, because my father was experiencing the world through World War II, and we were fighting against Nazism. I mean, what greater visible evil could we name? And yet the world has changed a lot since then, and he finally became an ardent opponent of the war in Vietnam. His worldview finally shifted out of that great war against Nazism, which even itself, there's some things that we could talk about. But I think at that point in our history, the convergence in this idea that somehow God and our country are almost synonymous, a lot of it probably grew out of that. So that's not surprising that that's where that took place. Other pieces of your conversation. Yeah?
Well, I added a bit about coming through the Vietnam War, the super patriots lining up with the flag so strong. When it became a flag versus religion, I got the impression that those super patriots were studying the flag to see what it said about God and told us that, instead of the vice versa. And that's how strong the flag became during the Vietnam War, part from another aspect of the division, a point of divisiveness even was the flag.
And one of the catchphrases for that kind of just really ultimate and narrow allegiance to a flag was love it or leave it, my country right or wrong, those kind of images. And those kinds of expressions were taking place not just outside of people of faith. So that's another, I think, good example of the problem of that kind of narrow, rigid allegiance.
But it's the right wing that really pushing.
But it's not the right wing that has flags in their churches. How many of you have flags, have the U.S. flag in your church?
Once in a while.
About half of us. So that's not, you know, it's a pretty, I would guess that the majority of ELCA Lutheran churches in this country have flags in them. Probably the vast majority. Anybody else?
We agreed that that it doesn't belong in the church. The thing that I was going to add to that is that I wonder if having the flag there for many people is an easy way of portraying yourself as a loyal American. It's the easy way of being of trying to portray yourself in that way instead of doing something about it.
Yeah, so that maybe having the flag there is just kind of an easy way of saying I'm a loyal patriotic. Which gets to the question we talked about in one of the forums, I guess, on the 4th of July, which was, you know, what does it mean to be a patriot, and can you be in opposition to your country and be patriotic? What does it mean to be patriotic in the context of faith? Those kinds of questions. Well, let me, anybody else who wants to share something who didn't? Otherwise, I'll, in the interest of time,
just having go ahead. The flag, and to take the flag out of the church, the opposition I got was from the VFW. And a couple of very influential people, you know, in the American Legion kind of people.
And oftentimes, I find...
It's kind of like stepping on American pie. I mean, it's like being against American motherhood and apple pie and all that.
Okay. So the opposition. And did you feel like when you were doing it in your church that it was a fairly narrow range of people that were really upset about it, and others thought, well, that's not... Maybe it doesn't belong here. Would that...
Very narrow one.
Okay. And oftentimes, the way we function as churches is we function as what I call the lowest common denominator. I mean, if we know that there's going to be three or four people who are going to say something, well, then we won't make a principled issue. But if we don't make those principled issues over time, I think it does have a bigger impact than we would maybe like to think.
Well, my mind is just going on. Would it also then be that we shouldn't take the tax advantage we take from the state?
Well, I think that's a very good question. Is the question of taxes. And there are there have been times in this country where during the activism of some of the churches during the Vietnam War, where that's when they started raising the question of should these churches be getting tax exemptions, etc. So, you know, how much is the church quietly stifling? Self-censorship is a major, major problem within the church, I think, and within the society as a whole. And how much does that tax break affect? I think it's a very good question. Let me share with you one other quote. But before doing that, just to remind you that this issue is ultimately comes down to the question of allegiance and the ultimate allegiance. I will tell you that I consider myself to be, I am a citizen of this country, and I take my citizenship very seriously. But I would also say that I'm very, very clear that I cannot pledge allegiance to the country. As a faith, out of my faith principle, I can only pledge allegiance to my God. And I mean that I think would be another question, is how do we deal with dual allegiances? Obviously, we are citizens and we have a special tie and special responsibility as citizens of this country. But it seems to me, unless we are clearly grounded in the understanding that our ultimate allegiance is to God, then we give up almost everything. The early Christians, the way they said that, is they were confronted with being forced to say that Caesar was Lord. And they wouldn't say it. They said, no, Christ is Lord. And they got eaten by lions. But it was a life and death issue for them. You could not make that compromise. Now, most of us try to have it both ways. And I think I would ask us to search the biblical message, particularly if any of what I've done in the last four sessions that paints a pretty conflictual view between our biblical values and our faith values and the foreign policy of this country, then I think we need to take that seriously. Here's the quote. We talked earlier about flags in one of the other sessions and about how the constitutional amendment debate about the flag and how the image of the flag is taking on more power, maybe even at a time where the freedoms that it's supposed to represent are being lost. Well, here's a quote from 1933, and the setting is Nazi Germany, a time when Adolf Hitler had just come to power. And the dean of a very large cathedral called the Magdeburg Cathedral, in which the swastikas were ringed the altar. The dean explained from the pulpit, and I'd ask you to think about the present debate within the United States. He said, "In short, the swastika flag has come to be the symbol of German hope. Whoever reviles this symbol of ours is reviling our Germany. The swastika flags around the altar radiate hope. Hope that the day is at last about to dawn." Now, many of us, I'm sure, have at one point or another said, how could it have happened in Nazi Germany? How could Christians have possibly let that happen? And yet, is it that much different to have flags sitting next to our altars? And will someday down the road, when people learn the real history of U.S. policy in Central America, will our grandchildren say, how did they let it happen? It's a rather eerie question for me. Okay, the next thing I want you to do is to go back into your groups of three or four, and I want to share with you something that Archbishop Romero did. And I want you to think about its significance for us if we were to do something similar. Archbishop Romero from El Salvador refused to participate in any function that would appear to give church legitimacy to a state that he considered to be unjust, to a government that he considered to be unjust. He wouldn't appear at presidential functions. He wouldn't pray over the latest weapon. He wouldn't do all kinds of things that routinely, religious leaders in this country do. Now, Romero also did a couple of things beyond not doing. He wrote a letter, for example, this is shortly before he was murdered. He wrote a letter to then President Jimmy Carter, and he said, stop funding this. Stop sending the money, because all it does is result in the death of my people. He also, on the eve, or the day before he was murdered, in his one of his final sermons that he preached, he made a special appeal to the armed forces to stop obeying their military leaders and to no longer kill, that they were killing their brothers and sisters. And he said, in the name of God, you do not have to obey the orders of men, people. You have to obey the orders of God. Thou shalt not kill. Now, the question I want you to talk a little bit about is, if Archbishop Romero made that principled stand in relation to El Salvador, and the United States government, which Romero pointed this out, and it's still true today, the United States government is the government that is continually financing for 10 more years since the death of Romero. We're paying for $1.5 million a day for the same thing to go on. Can we, in any way, legitimately as Christians, grant legitimacy to our government? That's the first question. Can we? If not, If some of you say, yes, we should, then I want you to explain that. If you say, no, we probably shouldn't, then I want you to go on and ask yourselves, what might that mean? What would it mean for us as Christian people and as churches to say in these times, in light of an organized war against the poor that we've talked about over the last week, in light of the session that I did midweek on why U.S.-backed governments murder priests and the persecution of the church, if we say, no, we shouldn't grant legitimacy in light of the earlier pledge that I hope all of us would make, which is the ultimate commitment to Jesus Christ as Lord, then what would that mean? What would withdrawal of our support, what forms might that take? Okay? So take about at least 10 minutes on that one. And then I want to hear what you come up with. And then we'll see what we come up with together. Okay. Sure. I'm going to get to that too. I promise tonight. Have it. Yep. I promise. Okay, let's pull back. Let's just hear a few of the insights that you gained from your small groups. What kinds of things did you talk about? Yeah.
Oh, it was really interesting to think about the, you know, we're talking about the difference of doing something within the establishment, trying to change the political system from within, versus that, but the strength of the establishment and the pull of the pressures and forces within it, that maybe, I don't think we answered the question, but maybe, you know, can we do anything from within, or do we have to do it, just stand outside completely? And the question I had was, it seems to me, from what little I know, that in the case of Central America, somebody like Romero, that they did very much at some point choose to stand outside the system completely. I mean, when he went to, in that particular neighborhood, that he completely stepped out of the establishment. But I think we're tempted a lot of times to change from within, and yet...
Yeah, Romero is one of the extremely rare people. I don't know if I could name another who, by virtue of his office as Archbishop, was absolutely within in terms of the church structure, and yet was isolated within his own hierarchy because he was so unusual, and yet did an incredible pastoral, organizational, and then prophetic task. He merged all. If you're interested in that, there's an excellent book by John Sobrino that came out by Orbis Books. I don't know the exact title of it, I just read it, but it just talks about this amazing prophet, this amazing man who did all of those things. But in terms of, as I mentioned, he did step out of, he would not give legitimacy to a state that he saw at war against its own people. And he would not kowtow to any powers that be, including the United States of America, on whom he placed a good share of the blame for its power hunger, power assertiveness, and for its financing. But the question that you raise is a very good one. It's a question of, do we have more legitimacy and more power to change things from within, or do we need to somehow creatively break away in order to have clarity of vision and purpose in order to somehow impact it? It's a good, very good question.
It's pretty hard for ordinary citizens to work within the system, but we don't, as individuals, we don't have that much power either to even step out of the system and say, hey, I'm going to stand for so-and-so. And she made a good point, and you share that with the group about prayer.
Well, I guess since you don't find the government legitimate, what are the ways that I can affect change? I think sometimes that's so overwhelming to me. How can I change this humongous system? And I just have to continue to pray to God that, you know, God will show me ways, and that God's will be done.
I'm going to come back to someone said, Jack, where's you promised you'd get the hope, and I'm going to talk about hope in just a couple minutes. Mm-hmm. But as I do, it's important to remember that as individuals, there are limits to what we can do. But that should not be an excuse for not doing. And that's where faith comes in. And I'll come back to that in a little bit. But just, and what I hear in our culture so many times is people saying, well, what I do doesn't matter anyway. And so then we just get caught up. And clearly from a biblical perspective, we can say that is not faithful. That is not acceptable. Certainly there are lots of passages about people feeling down in the dumps and overloaded and I can't do this and God, I'm just one person and all of that. But the response, you know, the faithful response is never then to acquiesce. It's that God promises to provide us with enough strength to get through. And I think that's really important.
What should we do about El Salvador?
Okay, I think we need to move into some practical things here in just a second. Go ahead.
I was just going to, I had an empowering experience for me on a different issue concerning gun control. I'd read a book and talking about the need to write your congressman. That is one place that you can do something. And what happened is I've been having a letter battle with my congressman. But if you become very convicted about something and you write, and I said to him, it was regarding these Brambo guns, and he was, I'm against it. He was trying to come up with, well, we need stronger capital punishment, and he would use all these excuses to go around the issue. And finally what's been happening is I said, if you do not change your position, and I will not vote for you, and I will also tell my friends what your position is. And what is interesting is this one little letter back and forth. You should see the speed of response that's coming back from this Congress. The office is like the first letter took 3 months, the next letter took 2 weeks, because they know I'm serious. And I think that, you know, it's something stupid and little, but you can, because you become convicted, they get worried. Mm-hmm. They don't know what you're going to do.
Congress people love letters that say, please send me information about. But if you start really taking a position and you say, I'm organizing people, they're more likely to listen. They won't always listen, but they're more likely to listen.
But I think that that's an accountability thing and a way of feeling like you have something that's some power.
Well, let me try to do three things in the few minutes that we have left. The one is I want to come back to this. What would it mean for us to withdraw some of our legitimacy from a government? Now, I'm going to make a very, very strong statement, and for the people who are here for the first time, again, you'll probably think I'm more crazy than you maybe already do. But I believe, in light of the strategy of warfare that I have spoken about over the last week and try to provide some insight into, that the moral dilemma that we face, our situation is different, but our moral and ethical dilemma as Christians isn't very different than Christians in Nazi Germany. Moral and ethically, we face a very similar situation. And part of that situation is a faith crisis. Because what happened in Nazi Germany was Hitler was enormously popular in the churches, including and especially the Lutheran Church. And that's part of a legacy that we need to learn from. If I'm right about that, and there may be only a few people in this room who would say that our moral and ethical dilemma are all of equal weight, and I would encourage those of you who don't to at least think about it and maybe read the book War Against the Poor and then think about it some more. But that's my conviction. And so I try to think of what are some creative ways of withdrawing support. And I'll talk more about some of the church issues later in the week. I'm going to talk about what third world Christians are saying to us as people of faith in this country, and what might we do in churches. But let me just name a couple of things. One form of withdrawal would be some form of tax resistance. Now, there are all kinds of ways to tax resist. When you send your taxes in, you can withhold $5 of what you were going to pay and say, I'm doing this in protest. At least you're making some statement that you don't like your tax dollars going to El Salvador and other places like that. Or in some parts of the country, and my wife and I live in Minneapolis, we consciously set our income for a lot of level, for a lot of reasons, lifestyle reasons, environmental concerns, but a lot about concern about where our taxes go. We set our income level at below the taxable income, and that's what we live on. We refuse to make more money that would bring us into a taxable bracket. And it's not because we don't like taxes. I think taxes are a good thing, should be a good thing, but they're not being used in a good way. Now, just to tell you, we give all kinds of other money, we give lots of money away because we do feel like our money, you know, there are some services and some things that governments provide that are very important that come through taxes. We try to make some of that up by giving money away, but we, on principle, do not want our tax dollars going to the federal government that is using it in El Salvador and lots of other places to carry out this warfare strategy I talked about. That's a form of withdrawal. Another form of withdrawal is to examine our employment. The thing that we're most accountable to God about is what we do with our time and our talents. And I think that each of us has talents. And whether we have time to use our talents in service to the community or in organizing against this stuff really depends upon the lifestyle choices we make. Are we going to chase after having more and more and more and more things and thereby get caught up into a cycle of consumption and then working to earn money and then consuming more, etc., and getting into a cycle of debt? Or are we going to make lifestyle choices that give us freedom to use our time? So part of withdrawing can be withdrawing from that kind of neurosis society so that we're freer to use the talents and the gifts that we have in service to the community. And the community can be as close to us as our neighbors to the global community. And all in relation to that is, I publicly advocate now that people who are part of the military need to withdraw from the military. That it is incompatible with Christian faith to serve in this military at this time. For lots of reasons. We could talk about the fact that there's this huge rush on now to find new enemies, that there's this huge rush within the military-industrial complex to justify these huge military expenditures even though Eastern Europe has fallen apart. Or we can talk about this calculated strategy of warfare against the poor. In either way, it's a time for withdrawal. It's a time to withdraw from military-related industries. And that's something that I think as Christians and as churches, one thing that we could do would be to help families who find themselves in a situation where their livelihood is based on what may now be unfaithful, unethical work. And that's a lot of people in this society. There's a tremendous amount of people who are built-in supporters for an arms race simply because that's where their livelihood. So those are examples of kind of creative withdrawing legitimacy. And if we took any of those actions seriously, we could bet that there's going to be enormous controversy starting to brew. There's going to be conversations going on in our churches. There's going to be conversations. And we need that. Part of the problem we have in our culture is it's a culture of relative silence in which just anything goes as long as it doesn't create any kind of public stir. You know, you go ahead and make your decision, but don't make it into a debatable issue. This would make it into a debatable issue. I promised that I would say a few words about Panama. And then I wanna close by sharing with you some perspectives on hope. So just a few brief words about Panama. The Panama invasion had nothing to do with Noriega's drug running. Okay? The Panama invasion, and this is in a summary of this will be in this book, which has a chapter that was added within the last couple of months. Basically, Panama was invaded, I think, for the following reasons. One, to reassert U.S. control over the canal. It took place about 2 weeks before Panama had the right to appoint who was going to run the canal. I mean, who would actually monitor the canal. It was done to further economically destabilize Nicaragua prior to the Nicaraguan elections. because Panama served, as you know, as many of you probably know, the U.S. had an economic embargo against Nicaragua, and one way to get partially around that embargo at higher prices was to get goods through Panama. So prior to the election, it was a way of further aggravating an already very seriously deteriorated economy. It was a way of intimidating Nicaraguan voters. When I met with people who, in August of last summer, who were again once again fleeing some of the rural areas, I said the Contras were campaigning. They were campaigning, campaigning in quotes, in the rural areas by selectively killing people as a sign, but also by just telling people that they had been assured by the United States that the only way that the war would end is if the Sandinistas lost the election. In other words, if you voted for the Sandinistas, you were voting for more war. And the invasion of Panama was meant to say to the Nicaraguan people, we're prepared to continue this war and perhaps even intervene with U.S. troops. A fourth reason was to take attention away from Salvador. Just as the U.S. invaded Grenada in response to the U.S. soldiers that were killed in Lebanon, that was one of the major reasons, was a psychological healing for the U.S. people. In a similar kind of way, invading Panama served a function of taking away attention from the fact that the U.S. government was killing priests, a U.S.-backed government was killing priests. And the fifth reason was to punish Noriega, because Noriega had been a staunch helper of the United States with the illegal Contra War. And I went into some detail in the last session of how it was Oliver North who made a deal with Manuel Noriega, allowing Noriega to run drugs into the United States in exchange for help from the Contras. Now, ironically, the real irony is that in the aftermath of the Panama invasion, the drug cartel got put back in power. That's what few U.S. people know. President Endara, the vice president, the new minister of the Treasury, the chief justice of the Supreme Court, of the, all those people in the new Panama government have significant ties to the drug trade in Panama. Now, on that cheery note, I want to say a few words about hope. And I don't take this issue of hope lightly, and I'm not going to be flippant at all about hope, because in all honesty, dealing with the subject matter that we've dealt with the last week, in 18 years of work on these issues, or related issues, this has been the most fundamental challenge to me, personally, as I struggle with hope. So I don't mean to be flippant about it, and I don't have any easy prescription for how we're going to leave the room smiling, okay? But with that in mind, let me just share with you, and I talk about hope in a chapter in this book called The Politics of Compassion. It's a whole section on hope, and I'll be summarizing a little bit of what's in there. But let me just make the following observations. We've got about 3 minutes. The first is that there is no hope without honesty. Within our culture, there's kind of a pervading view that it's better not to talk about these things because don't depress me. Let's go to a football game, or let's go to a baseball game. Or let's not talk about the environmental crisis being linked to our economy in the way it's structured because, geez, you know, don't spoil my day. It's nice and sunny out today. The best way that I learned the lesson about that you can't have hope without honesty was when my father was coughing up blood. And he went to a doctor, and the doctor told him, you don't have cancer, you have chronic bronchitis. And we heard exactly what we wanted to hear, so we didn't do anything. And about 8 months, 9 months later, he went to another doctor, they found the tumor, and he died in 3 weeks. Now, if we had been more honest and said, well, maybe we better go get some other opinions and find out what's going on, my father might have had a chance. I would say the same thing is true for us. Unless we honestly confront these things, there is no basis for hope. Second thing is that there's no hope unless we ourselves are willing to change. It's not enough for me to look at TV evangelists and say, boy, those guys are really out of it and they're distorting everything and they've really got to get their act together or our country's in trouble. I have to be willing to change. I need to be able to, in my life, make choices in the areas that I can control that reflect an urgency about these issues. And each of us can do that. We have some control over what we do with our own lives, but we need to be willing to change. A third lesson for me is there is no hope without patience. We need to be a patient people. I hope that some of you will take an opportunity to travel to Central America. And again, there's brochures on that in the Resource Center on how you might do that. But what you see when you go to El Salvador, you won't just see all gloom and doom amidst incredible oppression. You will see people organizing. You will see people who have been working for decades, continuing to work patiently with endurance. So we need patience. And certainly we can point to many biblical passages about that. You know, Sarah's, what, 99 when she finally gives birth, and lots of stories. The fourth thing is, there is no hope without action. Words aren't enough. We have to find vehicles to act. And that, again, act in our own personal lives, acting maybe in terms of public demonstrations, acting in terms of putting more legislative pressure on, but finding ways of expressing our concerns in our hands and with our bodies, not just in words. Another lesson for me about hope is that we can't be hopeful without humor and celebration. And Holden Village is a good place for that. I mean, there's Holden hilarity, and there's really serious grappling with issues that matter. And that's what life needs to be. I tell people somewhat jokingly, I used to think that anyone who smiled didn't know what was going on in the world, and I was going to set them straight. You know, a very ineffective way of talking to anybody about anything. So humor is really, really important. Humility. I'm not going to save the world. You're not going to save the world. But what we do matters. But to have not resignation, but humility. And certainly with the environment we're learning, we need to be much more humble about seeing ourselves as part of creation. In similar ways, when we act, we need to be humble. No hope without community. When people say, what can I do? The first thing I say is, you can't do it alone. We've got to find small groups. Maybe it's a small group on the edge of our church. Maybe it's a small group within our church. Maybe it's a small group where you work, where people are raising some questions about what you're doing at work. But you need to make connections or link up with organizations like Bread for the World or Witness for Peace or other groups that in an ongoing way provide us with information, and you get a sense that you're not alone out there working. There's no hope without faith for me. And Romero is the best example of that that I have. Romero was able to do what he did. He underwent an incredible personal conversion because of the death of his people. And it turned him into, what I think, he's a saint. He's the most Jesus-like figure that I know of in my lifetime, at least. It was because of the depth of his faith. And then finally, there's no hope without seeking structural changes. We have to find ways of getting our compassion rooted in the political and economic arena. It's not enough just to be personally compassionate. So that's not a blueprint for change. What should we do in El Salvador? We should be clamoring at our congresspeople's doors right now, not letting them get away with sending one more penny to that government. We should be doing everything that we can to expose this strategy of warfare and the dangers it poses not only to people in Central America, but here. But in El Salvador, read, if you can get a copy of it, which shouldn't be too hard to find, read Archbishop Romero to Jimmy Carter. More than 10 years ago, he sent it, and every word, 10 years, 50 or 60,000 more dead people in El Salvador, and it's the same message. Nothing has changed. Nothing has changed.
How did Carter respond to that?
By increasing the aid. Yep, Carter was the beginning of the disaster in El Salvador. And the Reagan administration took it and ran with it. Okay, that we gotta stop. It's 7:17 on my watch at least. Well, thank you very much for coming to this session. I hope to see some of you who are new, maybe to follow through now starting in the week, where we'll talk about some of the issues that led this maniac to say what he said to me. Thank you.